Hi, this is Thomas Ratliff, member of the State Board of Education from Northeast Texas, welcoming you to this week's TribCast. I'm actually being held against my will, but when Evan Smith asks you to do something, you simply say, "Thank you, sir. May I have another?" So without further ado, here's this week's TribCast.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the TribCast for the third week of August. Joining me is CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
I want to make it clear that I have never swatted Thomas Ratliff on his bottom.
Maybe in other areas.
Yeah, that was unnecessarily
that was very specific.
Yeah,
well, but it was an Animal House. It's back to the Animal. He made an Animal House joke.
Oh, no.
I'm acknowledging the Animal House joke.
That was no joke. There are no jokes on this TribCast.
I will only answer to Marmalard for the entire podcast.
Niedermeyer.
Executive editor Ross Ramsey is also here.
Howdy.
You're kind of the Niedermeyer of this podcast,
nice.
Are you?
We're starting there, huh?
We are.
And so who is reporter Morgan Smith?
Hello.
Blutarsky?
Senator Blutarsky?
The four of us will be talking...
And you, Pinto.
Anyway.
You're offended by that? Go ahead. It was a joke asking to be made.
We're talking about... What are we talking about? This is the first TribCast since Paul Ryan became the vice presidential candidate, and we will talk about what that means for Texas.
Well, it means that the best Hey Girl reference is now no longer Josh Trevino. That Hey Girl, it's Paul Ryan thing is actually very funny.
Did you not think the Josh Trevino one was funny? This is, of course, Josh Trevino, formerly of the Texas Public Policy Foundation, now of Texas Monthly and The Guardian.
And a
and
Tumblr
hey girl,
meme.
Hey girl, it's
yes,
Josh
a Tumblr meme. When you, yes. When you become a Tumblr meme, your moment has arrived. That's right. Yeah. No, the Paul Ryan has electrified everything.
Yeah, it's sort of the, you know, it's Romney makes a grasp for, you know, kind of the Donna Campbell vote. In the parts of the Republican electorate where they were looking at Romney and they're seeing an establishment guy, now they see a guy who's, you know, like Ted Cruz, probably from the establishment, but also listening to the enervated, excited part of the Republican Party. You know, the Tea Party faction, certainly the fiscal conservatives that were the original Tea Party and the populist wave in the Republican Party, you know, this is a candidate for those guys. Whether it'll work or not, you know, that remains to be seen.
Would you really say he's electrified everything? You sort of think of electricity as sort of going out from you, and it seems more like it's directed inward towards
I think he's electrifying the Republican base to the degree that Mitt Romney had not electrified the Republican base before.
Right.
Is it an issue that he might be alienating more the moderates and this is a general election?
Yes. And old people potentially?
Well, right. I mean, but you've got this thing where all they had with Romney was, you know, we're sort of, you know, there was this great New Yorker cartoon where somebody had a sign in their front yard that said, "Romney, I suppose." Right? They're sort of resigned to it. This is our guy. He's not very exciting. He's a traditional Republican sort of, okay. And the election was really sort of about, but you want to get rid of Obama, right? And now it's also about this fiscal conservative and some ideas other than just
Obama. What it's about now is not just what are you against, but what are you for,
right,
with an asterisk. And
right,
the asterisk is that Romney seems not to necessarily be for what Paul Ryan is for. You know, he's not fully embraced or even given kind of like a bro hug even to the Ryan budget. And this has become a big issue since Ryan was announced, because you surf off of or you dine out on the Ryan enthusiasm, but then when it comes to the substance that Ryan, you know, provides, or is at the bottom of that enthusiasm, what are they enthusiastic about? They're enthusiastic about the guy's ideas.
Right.
If you're then not going to embrace the ideas, then it's sort of like, well, what's the point? But if you do embrace the ideas, to Morgan's point, there are moderates in the general election and there are seniors in Florida. And there are people all over the country who are going to go, "I don't know about this."
All right, so, is Florida still a swing state?
It's a trick. Wisconsin may be.
Right.
I'm just not sure Florida is. And, you know, it's a high-risk, high-reward pick. That's been said. That's the conventional wisdom. I think there's validity to that. If he loses, he may lose big, but he'll lose with principle as opposed to Romney, as opposed to, you know, making a safe choice and having it be this kind of like, meh, meh, meh kind of thing. Right?
Right.
I think so. What does it mean? Does it mean anything for Texas? Texas is still going to vote for the Romney blank ticket with Ryan in it or not?
Yeah, Texas was in the bag. I guess it could help them with fundraising at some point. Texas is the, you know, apparently the leading ATM right now. MapLight, which does research on these things, tracks money and influence in politics, put out a thing this morning. We're taping on Wednesday. Put out a thing that said Texas is the busiest state, both in contribution percentage and in total amount, for super PACs. So of the $306 million so far tracked to super PACs, $60 million, or 19.7%, has come from Texas. So we've got some purpose in this. And I guess if you're going to come through Texas dragging the sack, having a fresh face certainly doesn't hurt. Romney's been through a bunch of times, and now Romney and his blue-eyed friend are here going to come through raising money.
But he's not electrifying the base the way Sarah Palin electrified the base last time around.
I don't think they want to be electrified the way they were Sarah Palin.
I think he's electrifying the intellectual base as opposed to the emotional base. I think that the thoughtful conservatives who are people of ideas, of which there are many in Texas, you know, they don't agree with one another on everything, but they generally have a different worldview than the president, say, and they want this to be a campaign of ideas. They don't want it to simply be, you know, months of negative ads, we hate Obama, without actually saying what they're for. I think for them, they now have somebody they can hang their hat on. Romney didn't really put forward a very specific program. Romney was essentially running as the not Obama candidate,
right. except for when what is her name, Saul, comes out and sort of uses his healthcare plan as his great defense and his great policy achievement.
Look, what Ryan does is give people something to vote up or down on, not just to vote down on.
Right,
and that's for Romney a good thing. It wouldn't have been that way with Portman or Pawlenty, probably. It might have been that way with Chris Christie, but his options at this point were to go big or go home, and he went big.
And I wouldn't completely discount the emotional piece of this. I mean, you know, Romney clearly wasn't fulfilling that, and sort of the, you know, Ryan has some rock star qualities for the Republican electorate, and some the ability to get a crowd excited and worked up, and you know, some of the positive sides of Sarah Palin exist here.
And so, is this what we focus on for the next two to three months? Have we just sort of given up on the Texas races at this point, just because there's
The presidential race, you know, certainly through the conventions, is going to be the ticket here. And, you know, a lot of the Texas races, you know, there aren't a lot of them. We've talked about that. There are only about a dozen House races, you know, probably one Senate race, maybe two or three congressional races. And the top of the ticket seems destined for Republican land unless something fundamental changes. So none of that changes unless the presidential race changes it.
Which is the other Senate race you're talking about that's competitive? Wondering.
Well, you've got a couple of Senate races that are inside the lines. If, you know, inside the environment, the political voting in the Oreste district, and I can't remember the other one off the top of my head, you know, theoretically, if it's a great Republican year, those could go Republican. The Oreste district.
You think Chewy Hunahouse is in trouble potentially?
I don't think he's in trouble, but you know, if you just look at that race on paper and not on personality, if it's a big Republican year, that could be a swing district. The Oreste district could be a swing district. But the race to watch is clearly the Wendy Davis race up in Fort Worth. It's where all the money's going to be. This is Wendy Davis versus Mark Shelton. Clearly, where all the money's going to be. You know, to some extent, control of the Senate is in play. To some extent, it's, you know, a classic, you know, it's just a classic Republican versus Democrat fight. And, you know, that's going to be a lot of fun. But there are a bunch of races that, whether they're races or not, is going to depend on whether there's a race at the top of the ticket and whether there's some excitement at the top of the ticket and what kind of people that draws out. So 2008 was the year it was in Texas, in some ways, not because the Democrats were winning at the top of the ticket, but because the Democrats at the top of the ticket were drawing out so many people that it influenced races down the ballot. If Obama pulls in a bunch of people or if Romney pulls in a bunch of people, it may or may not change the top of the ticket in Texas, but it may change it in this House district or that House district or this congressional
district. So if the enthusiasm for Romney goes up because Ryan's on the ticket, as opposed to somebody who did not electrify the Donna Campbell wing, as you described it earlier, Ryan's a net plus then for Tea Party candidates and other Republicans on the ballot in a greater way and in tight races.
Right. If I'm in a tight race or if I'm in a swing district and suddenly something else, the presidential ticket or whatever, something else draws a bunch of new Republicans or draws a bunch of new Democrats, that could influence my race. A bunch of people won in 2008 who wouldn't have otherwise won. A bunch of people won in 2010, you know, in state races, frankly, because a lot of Republicans were really, really mad at Washington.
I've thought that the a data point that is not often discussed about the Wendy Davis-Kim Brimer race in 08 is that Obama won four of the five big counties but lost Tarrant County. So if Obama, at the height of his popularity, lost Tarrant County, Wendy Davis was able to win. My suspicion is Obama loses Tarrant County this time by a greater margin than he did last time. Now, the Mark Veazey congressional race may turn out an African-American vote and mitigate that to some degree. But I suspect that one of the problems for Wendy Davis this time will be the difference between 08 and 12 with regard to the top of the ticket.
And how excited are Republicans in that district? You know, obviously the Democrats were excited last time she ran.
Yeah.
Maybe the Republicans will be more excited. This is where these kind of factors come in.
But is Ryan moving them from excited to very excited, or from not at all excited to paying attention?
I think from, you know, your butt on the couch to your butt in the voting booth. It's just getting turnout in a district like that.
Well, the other place where it may matter is in the race to succeed Ron Paul between Randy Weber and Nick Lamson,
right,
where maybe some of the Ron Paul-style voters might have been looking at Romney and saying, feh. But they get Ryan on the ticket and they go, well, right, maybe I'm more interested in this.
Right.
You expect that race to be competitive?
You know, I think that race could be competitive. It's not. It's one of those races, like the Senate races we were talking about, that on paper it probably shouldn't be. It's probably a Republican district, but you're running a former congressman in Nick Lamson against someone who's never run at that level. Lamson's run in some parts of the district. Weber is run in some parts of the district. If it's a year where some of these external factors, you know, draw voters, it could be competitive. I think Lamson is going to get a look from national Democrats, and particularly national Democrats with money, that an untested or, you know, newbie Democrat wouldn't get.
On the other hand, if the national Democrats have one of those cartoon bags of money with a dollar sign on it, and they're going to give that money to one
CD23,
it's going to be Pete Gallego, not Nick Lamson.
Right. The Gallego-Canseco race is, by any measure, a swing district.
Yep.
And both of the, you know, within hours, or actually within a few minutes of the runoff election results on the Democratic side, I had emails from the Republican Congressional Committee and from the Democratic Congressional Committee congratulating and starting their engines. So that's going to be a race anyway.
Well, let's move on to something that some of these people might have to talk about when they get into their respective offices, and that is the failing schools in Texas, which Morgan can fill us in on.
Well, it depends on by what measure you call them failing, but
whatever measures I want. If I say they're failing, they're failing.
By No Child Left Behind benchmark standards, 44% of Texas schools are actually meeting the yearly progress benchmarks that they're supposed to under No Child Left Behind. And the goal is by 2014 for 100% of them to be meeting these standards. And so,
room for improvement.
Yes, and this is, of course, based on students' performance on end of the year standardized tests in reading and in math. And so, last week we got this report that came out from the TEA that said, you know, more than half of Texas schools are failing to meet No Child Left Behind. And it kind of made a big splash, but at the same time, pretty much everybody knew that this was going to happen, that this was going to be bad news coming out, but that it didn't necessarily reflect that anything different is happening in Texas schools.
Have our results been getting worse, or is this the first time we're getting?
So what happened was, in this each year under No Child Left Behind, the standards that schools have to meet are gradually increased. So last year, I think we were maybe around like upper 50s, 60% of schools meeting the standards. Now we're at 44%, but also a greater number of students had to pass their tests in order to get to that point.
And what's the standard now? It's a relatively low standard.
It's a pretty low standard. I think it's like 83% for math and 87% for English have to pass. And I think when you look at how well students have to do to pass these tests, you know, that's also not a very high standard. So, uh-huh.
And yet they still can't do that.
And yet they yes. And also, if you look at the waiver, is pretty much everybody agrees that No Child Left Behind hasn't been working out that well. 2/3 of states have already applied for waivers from the federal government to be exempted from having to meet the requirements. Texas has still refused to apply for this waiver. The next deadline is September 6th, but that is also not you know, the last time that that can happen, there's kind
what's
of...
What's the waiver? If you, yeah. don't, if you don't meet the standard, then you don't get the money? Or what's the,
explain
how's the waiver
what the argument so, is actually for applying for it.
For applying for the waiver is basically that you that your schools won't will be exempted from whatever sanctions start to apply if your schools are failing for a certain number of years. That includes being taken over by a charter operator or, you know, forced staffing changes, various things like that. Texas has said we're not applying for the waiver because we don't like the strings attached. It kind of goes back to our argument for not participating in Race to the Top. We're not using the Common Core curriculum standards in our classrooms. We don't necessarily agree with certain teacher evaluation practices that are connected to applying to a waiver. It goes back to the whole federal intrusion into state classroom argument.
It's like the Olympics, though. I mean, it's like we're not going to compete in the high jump because we can't jump that high.
I mean, there's more to it than that. There's a principle at work here. Those guys would tell you, Perry and everybody else would say, we just don't want to have to toe behind the federal government.
Do we not take pride in a system that was passed by a Texan that came largely
well, Margaret,
out of Texas.
Margaret Spellings and Sandy Crest, two of the people who are actually quite instrumental in the development of this stuff, you know, aren't very happy about the state of affairs here. And, you know, there is some tension, absolutely, between the last regime and the current regime as far as that goes.
Well, isn't one way out of this, you don't have to apply for a waiver if you pass the standard?
Yeah, just pass the damn standard.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. If you could jump this high, if you could, you know, you don't need a waiver if you were competitive. You're not competitive.
And it's also bad timing for school districts because we are moving into the STAR exams, which are more rigorous.
It's a whole other problem.
Much more difficult. We're not used to taking tests in this way. So it's kind of a bind.
Are the standards for the No Child Left Behind stuff like the STAR test where, like, each time you know, the tests have been getting harder and harder and harder. And so, like, when Evan would have taken the STAR test as a youngster, he would have taken a much easier test.
As a young Texan.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. He would have taken a much easier test than his son, for example.
Living in a remote location.
Well,
off my land.
Satellite Texas.
Right. Right. So the requirements for districts to qualify, or for students to qualify, is passing under No Child Left, or the amount of students that need to pass under No Child Left Behind have increased year by year as we march towards 2014.
Well, if we had an education commissioner, maybe we could talk to that person about the subject.
Yeah, who's in charge?
The headless horseman.
How fast are we supposed to get one? Is there any?
So the chief deputy commissioner, who's Todd Webster, who's kind of managing things for the past month or so since Robert Scott has left.
Who played Tom Hagen to Robert Scott, right? He was kind of the consigliere of the TEA.
Yes, exactly. He is supposed to leave...
second movie reference of the...
At the end of
the
August. Yeah. And so some of the thinking is that, you know, it'd be great to get a new commissioner in there before kind of the head guy who's been basically running everything leave so that they can have some kind of overlap. So that would mean that this announcement is supposed to come pretty soon. However, I mean, I guess you just never know with these things. And then the other thing is even if Todd Webster leaves, there's still, you know, a fair amount of senior people who will be around. And depending on the choice that the governor makes, they might actually end up being the people who would run most of the things behind the scenes anyways. If the governor decides to go with, you know, say a Michael Williams type choice, who, you know, somebody who doesn't necessarily have a lot of policy background in public education, but it can be kind of the public face of the agency, and the governor trusts to kind of get what he wants done.
Do you have to have any sort of, is there any requirement for who gets this? I mean, for a long time, it was people who'd been former superintendents or prominent school board members, you know, sort of the Mike Moses, Jim Nelson, Skip Mino, you know, that kind of model.
Yeah, there was kind of this, you know, gentleman's agreement between the governor at least during the Bush and Ann Richards years, where the commissioner would alternate between being a former superintendent and a former school board president. And then really with Robert Scott in 2006, that shifted, and that was kind of a big transition. But there isn't necessarily requirements certain requirements that the commissioner has to meet. I think it really is, you know, who the governor thinks would be best for the job.
But most of the names floating around now aren't people with that kind of expertise.
The discussion is a loyalty pick as opposed to an expertise pick.
Right.
Which is not a knock on Michael Williams or anybody else who's been mentioned, but the reality is we're not hearing a lot of names coming out of the education community. We're hearing more names coming out of the, quote, political community.
Right.
Right, and the idea is, you know, the governor makes a loyalty pick and then you have people with the expertise behind the scenes who can kind of handle
it's like
what
when Magic Johnson or Michael Jordan buys a sports team. They're not actually going to run it day to day. They're more of the face. And I think Michael Williams would be a great face for an agency. He's a very compelling personality. He was a good candidate for office, even though he didn't win the congressional race. But he, by his own admission, would probably tell you he's not really an education expert.
Right.
How steep do you think the learning curve is on that job, or is it just being the face?
I mean, I think that's the thing is that... You know, I think it probably is a pretty steep learning curve.
It's only an incredibly large agency with, you know, a huge staff that's scrutinized more than a lot of the others. It has one of the worst websites in the state.
Well, and you're going into, I mean, you know, October we've got the...
Sounds like the Tribune.
Yeah. October we've got...
Who
October,
will also be undergoing the Sunset Review process in the next year.
Right, Sunset Review. In October all the school finance suits go to trial. Right, legislature's so going to tear into the stuff. You know, it's a learning curve.
Okay, so here's a bitchy question.
Oh, please.
Yeah. You have both Florence Shapiro and Rob Eisler returned to the private sector, one voluntarily, one involuntarily. Both of them know quite a lot about public education.
Right.
I can understand Perry not picking Scott Hochberg, but you've got both Florence and Rob available out there now for, you know, to be plucked away to be the head of TEA. Why not them?
I had a funny conversation with an education lobbyist and said, you know, what do you think about Florence Shapiro becoming education commissioner? And he said, I would really hate that. And I said, why? And he said, because I really like Florence.
Oh, well. A job no one would want.
Yeah.
Shapiro has a pretty good setup over there at Academic Partnerships.
Right. And I think it is, I mean, I think I've even said this on this podcast before, is that it is a thankless...
That's a standard now?
Yes. Not repeating yourself is a requirement of the job. We're all screwed, so...
It is...
Where do we get to our next topic? Who's going to win in 2010?
It's a thankless job. It's
this podcast?
Yes, coming on this podcast. Being education commissioner is a thankless job in many ways. And, you know, a lot of the... Even when you look at, you know, superintendents, it might be good for the job. In a lot of cases, they're probably already making more money doing what they're doing. They don't have to...
Especially that guy in Beaumont.
Right. They don't have to be subject to these, you know, very competing demands from the governor's office, from the legislature, from all of the school districts. It's kind of the position where you may end up just being constantly beat up on from various factions.
It does sound like the Tribune.
Yeah. Sounds like being a reporter at the Tribune.
A job no one would want.
Just horrific. It's terrible.
Do you think that whoever this person is, will their priority number one be to get us to be a little more successful on the No Child Left Behind standards? Or no? Or are we just giving up on that?
I mean, I think the general consensus on No Child Left Behind is that at some point, Congress is going to be forced to do something about it. And I mean, while I think, you know, accountability type issues, student performance on assessments, you know, efficiency of school districts is going to be first priority, I don't know that No Child Left Behind is going to be first priority, except in that it's going to be part of, you know, probably the general conversation that's happening about Texas school districts. And I'm sure it will be trotted out, you know, to talk about, you know, how bad our schools are, how, you know, why should we give them more money, that type of conversation, if that, you know, ends up happening during the legislative session.
Well, it looks like the political heat right now, just if you're listening to what people are saying in their campaigns, is all around the STAR test and about the 15%, about it counting toward 15% of people's grades.
So you come into that job.
And then the next piece of heat comes in October when the judge says whatever the judge says about school finance. That's a budget problem.
So you come in, you got that job, you got to deal with the accountability stuff, you got to deal with the financing stuff.
Right.
You've got to deal with the fact that the budget of TEA itself to do its job is significantly below what it was prior to the last legislative session.
Cut by a third, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's truly not a job that a lot of people would want.
Well, put an asterisk on that for a minute, because the conversation during the legislative session about cuts in education was largely about, you know, you're going to cut funding to these districts. It's going to mean this many teachers lose jobs, you know, yada, yada, yada. And the second year is going to be worse than the first. And sort of the news lately has been that districts are hiring more teachers. Help me here, Morgan. Or districts are hiring more teachers than maybe they thought they would, or than maybe that. And really the metric that we're ignoring, or that they seem to be ignoring politically, is kids can't pass these tests.
Yeah, and I think this is... I mean, maybe it's kind of a messaging issue on the front part of, you know, pro-education type groups, that, you know, maybe it is easier to point out, you know, to point out as far as impact is concerned, like, these people are losing their jobs. But I think I do think some people were raising this issue. But if you say, OK, look at how our students are doing, you know, maybe that's something that is more appealing towards lawmakers, or kind of less easy to take down by pointing out, okay, well, this district didn't fire as many people, and this district is actually giving bonuses to their teachers, using that kind of argument. I think that as far as, you know, student performance is concerned, that it's just, I mean, I guess what somebody might counter that with is, well, our districts, they have enough money, they're just not using it efficiently.
Right. Well, it's interesting to me that the conversation isn't more tuned to why aren't the schools great. You know, if you were looking at this as an array of choices for your kid, and you said, you know, you can go here, you can go here, you can go here, your conversation would all be about where do you get the best education, and wouldn't be about, you know, where the teachers get the most money or all of that kind of stuff. It just seems like a really interesting backwards argument.
Yeah, and actually, I think, you know, we might be starting to have that kind of conversation during the next legislative session if, you know, like Senator Dan Patrick recently said, we see a move towards voucher legislation or some form of school choice legislation.
Well, that makes the pick for Dewhurst really interesting. I mean, you know, Patrick lays down this gauntlet last week in the Chronicle. Is that where he was? Houston Chronicle?
Yeah, in the Chronicle.
Where he said vouchers will be the voter ID of the next legislative session. So if you're David Dewhurst and you're trying to figure out who to replace Florence Shapiro with as head of the Education Committee, Public Education Committee, do you go with Patrick for having said that? Does that look like you're signaling your own intentions, or do you
Patrick,
go with Seliger,
who endorsed Dewhurst at great peril politically to himself?
Right, and Cruz only won Harris County by something like 2-1,
100,000 votes.
Right,
payback time.
Right. Well, or do you go with Seliger or something else? I mean, does it? If Dewhurst were to pick Patrick, does that say Dewhurst is with him on this voucher thing?
We haven't even talked about if Dewhurst is going to be lieutenant governor next session.
I think he is. I mean, there's this speculation in the lobby that, you know, Dewhurst will go home and his tail's so far between his legs that he'll just quit. I don't think so. I don't see that.
It's going to be a hell of a time to be the maybe as thankless a job as TEA commissioner is, maybe being lieutenant governor.
He may be free. He doesn't have to run for anything. You know,
so we'll finally see the real Dewhurst?
He's a free man.
Well, just very quickly, while this is still a current event, do you think the tragic events in College Station this past week will mean that he has to preside over any campus carry legislation if he is there?
Well, the person who carried the campus carry has been carried out of the Senate.
Was that a pun?
No, it was a statement.
Yeah, Jeff Wentworth's not here anymore. I mean, do you come in after this Texas A&M shooting is what you're referring to. Do you come in after that, and does that affect
campus
carry?
See, he's part of the problem.
Right, I know. I mean, really, the issue with this thing is that it's not really a campus carry issue, this one event.
Right, it's because it was a block from campus, and it says A&M in every headline, even the headlines that say this wasn't about A&M.
But who, I mean, after Wentworth, who is the next champion of campus carry?
Tons of people, you know, co-sponsored that.
He had 19.
It co-sponsored it, and it conveniently did not pass. But I mean,
and Joe Driver is the person that's been carrying it in the House, and he is gone for reasons unknown.
Somebody will pick it up. I don't have any doubt that, you know, the Texas State Rifle Association's out there talking to senators and would-be senators right now, and the Senate is going to be more conservative than it was. But the question is, do shootings like this one color that conversation and that debate? And I think they clearly do. I don't know that the state legislature is any more any less conservative or less pro-gun than they were, you know, 4 days ago.
And Aurora, Colorado, and the Sikh shooting in Wisconsin, and this deal at A&M or in College Station is not going to change people's points of view. One of the very first voices we heard after the shooting in College Station was Governor Perry saying, yeah, we're not going to change anything about gun rights in Texas.
Right.
So at some point, one of these shootings may precipitate some reaction, but I don't think we're there yet. No indication that we are there yet.
Right. And the counter-argument seems to be, or one of the counter-arguments seems to be, it's not a gun issue, it's a mental health issue. And maybe we ought to be talking about mental health issues. And, you know, a lot of these guys were sort of on the radar.
Jerry Patterson said that in his interview with the Tribune. He was like, well, the difference between now and back in the day is that we have crazy people.
And, of course, we didn't
have crazy people before. Now, that guy will make a great lieutenant governor.
If you have any questions, comments, or prospective applications for to be the next lieutenant governor, feel free to email them.
Yes, if you want to announce your candidacy, you can do a podcast next week that doesn't mention having another or whatever that Thomas Ratliff said.
Only you would know. You were the one
that was
there.
I guess so.
Right. There will be spankings.
We'll let Thomas Ratliff out of the cage that he's been kept in for this podcast.
Yeah, if you would like Thomas
shy and retiring, exactly.
If you would like Thomas Ratliff delivered to your door, I mean, if you're one of the Bradley brothers, tribcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of Evan, Ross, Morgan, and our producer Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Didn't bleed very much at all,
didn't?
Actually. No. It just hurts.